Welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later.
You have this sense of an oligarchy, and it is transnational, enabled by the secrecy world.
We talk to Pulitzer Prize winner Jake Bernstein about his new book, Secrecy World. No time for headlines this month. This is an extended TaxCast. Except I do want to throw in an interesting piece of news. Facebook has just announced it will stop using the tax haven of Ireland to slash its global tax bills. It's getting started on that apparently in 2018 and is going to start declaring advertising revenue in the actual country where it's sold instead of rerouting that through Ireland. And that puts some pressure on other big companies like Google and Apple, so let's watch out for that in 2018. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, so we're going backwards pretty fast in the United States. President Trump's tax reform bills, the big talking point this month, the most significant reforms since Reagan's time in the 1980s. Ordinary people even more bearing the higher tax burden than corporations and the super rich. So oligarchy USA, here we come. The rich have had a better and a better ride over the decades, haven't they? Because we're looking at the average tax rates that they're paying now, going back to 1920s levels again.
Yeah, that's right. Trump's proposals for the high net wealth individuals, that takes us back to the 1920s and to the era of Scott Fitzgerald's gilded elites. And I think that's where the United States is heading now. As someone commented earlier this week in the light of the Senate vote, this can only lead to very, very high levels of wealth and income inequality. And that can only lead to a very unhappy ending in a country which has minimal gun controls.
Yes. Let's look at the estate tax, otherwise known as the death tax, or what we might call inheritance tax in Britain.
Yeah, so different treatments, because the House of Representatives are talking about outright abolition of the estate tax. The Senate is talking about raising the threshold, the exemption level, to something of the order of $11.5 million. Which is, by any standards, an enormous exemption level. This is a measure which the right have been pushing for many, many decades. In America, they've christened it the death tax in an attempt to kind of tarnish it. But in many respects, the inheritance tax, as it's called in other countries, is a very progressive tax because it allows people to accumulate capital gains over the course of their lifetime, which are then taxed away at death. A very fair and quite progressive measure. In most countries, including the United States, it only applies to the very, very, very wealthy people. So this so-called death tax is a tax break for the very, very rich indeed.
And after 6 years, they will abolish it completely under these proposals.
That's right. Even if you look at some of the measures which are targeting average earners, most of those tax breaks phase out quite rapidly in the coming years, after which most families, particularly families with an income of less than $75,000, they will actually end up paying more tax. And it seems to me that quite a few of the measures which are likely to be unpopular are phased in over the longer term, so that people think more about what happens to them immediately. This seems to me to be a political ploy which we're seeing adopted increasingly by political parties, by governments, in order to take some of the poison out of the pills which they're providing.
In terms of corporate taxation, they want to cut the corporate income tax rate from 35% to 20%. Not that very many of the really big companies are paying 35 or 20%, actually. And if the current trend continues on this race to the bottom between nations on tax, Eurodad had a report out recently, the NGO, estimating that the global average corporate tax rate will hit 0% by 2052. And they're basing that on the decline trajectory since 1980, when the average corporate tax rate was over 40%, taking up that all the way to 2015, where it's dropped to less than 25%. And we've got countries like Hungary dropping to 9%. Yep. Yep. So this is a road to nowhere.
It's a road to nowhere, but I think it's wrong to think that it'll stop at zero, because actually, given the political power of capital, in other words, big businesses, they can exert enormous political pressure for subsidies. So it doesn't stop at zero. We're going to enter into negative income tax on corporations as they push for more subsidies, you know, more cheaper energy or more investment in roads to meet their needs or training programs to meet their needs, etc., etc., etc. So it doesn't stop at zero. It'll go into negative territory. In other words, we're moving almost inexorably towards a period of subsidized capitalism, which is madness. Because as we know, at the same time, multinational companies are making huge profits and they don't know what to do with their cash reserves. With the United States now proposing to drop their tax rate from 35% down to a nominal rate of 20%, we can expect others to react. And they're all reacting downwards. The real danger lies with kind of outlier countries, countries like Britain. If you talk to some of the government ministers, they'll say that very clearly they're interested in simply abolishing the corporate income tax and not replacing with any tax whatsoever. And when that happens, those outliers might well drive a sudden kind of leap in that race to the bottom. So if anything, I think the Eurodad estimate of mid-century before we see the tax rates the nominal tax rate hit zero might well be a conservative estimate. It might well happen well before then.
Okay. There's a serious human cost to all this as well, as has been pointed out by the Center for Economic and Social Rights in the United States in their submission to a United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, Professor Philip Alston, who's making an official visit there to investigate poverty and human rights deprivations. Obviously, we have to finance these tax cuts, and a lot of social programs are being cut as a result. And we've got estimates like 10,000 possible avoidable deaths because of the withdrawal of some affordable healthcare provisions.
I think this tax package is likely to lead to mayhem further down the route. And the big question hanging over the bill is whether it will actually do anything towards achieving his goal of making America great again. And here we can look at the example of the state of Kansas, which 5 years ago in 2012 adopted a package of very similar tax cuts targeted at rich people. And the aim there in Kansas was to stimulate investment and jobs growth. Now, the outcome has been little short of a catastrophe for Kansas. They now, this fiscal year, they're facing a deficit of something of the order of $350 million. Next year, that's likely to rise to something closer to $600 million. This is a very small state. And accompanying this deficit, you have savage cutbacks to public services, including education, infrastructure maintenance, health services, the whole lot. And, of course, the promised economic miracle, which was being presented at the time when these cuts were introduced in 2012 in Kansas, that economic miracle simply failed to materialize. It is more likely than not we'll see something similar, but on a much, much bigger scale across the entire United States. Huge increase in the deficit. Remember, America, you know, the United States already have a deficit of something of the order of $20 trillion. No stimulus whatsoever to investment. It's more likely that any savings that the rich achieve will be spent on, you know, in the case of corporations, they'll spend that on higher dividend payments to their very wealthy owners and on share buybacks, which is what's been happening in the last few years. So no stimulus to investment. Very few real good, well-paying jobs being created. Rich people will get richer. Kansas provides a very interesting example of how this might go very badly wrong.
Yes, and for all we know, this may not even pass because of a slight change in the makeup of the Democrats on the one side and the Republicans on the other. And there's one holdout rebel Republican, thank goodness for that.
Yeah, that's right. We hear the results from Alabama, and that's quite dramatic because we have a very tight situation in the Senate Alabama has switched from Republican to Democrat now. After 25 years, quite astonishing result in some respect. And Republican Bob Corker from Tennessee stood out. He voted against the bill when it went to the Senate earlier this week. So the situation really is now something of a tightrope, that the whole bill could fall in the coming weeks as the conference between the House of Representatives and Senate goes on, because, of course, the two bills, the one of the House of Representatives, is quite significantly different from the bill that went through the Senate. So there's going to be quite a lot of negotiation around that before the president can sign off on the bill. And we're clearly seeing a switch of mood in the United States going against the Trump administration.
Okay. Let's talk about the European Union's new blacklist of tax havens or uncooperative jurisdictions, now long awaited, and what a letdown. We had 17 in the end countries on their blacklist. We've got countries like Panama, Grenada, Trinidad and Tobago, St. Lucia, Barbados, Tunisia, Namibia, Mongolia, some really, really quite small and economically not very powerful and politically not very powerful jurisdictions. No EU countries on the list. And of course, the United States wasn't on it either. Tax haven USA. You can't really make this stuff up, can you?
It's astonishing. And seeing the politics of this is just extraordinary. It's given that blacklists have had such a bad reputation. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development has produced several blacklists in the last 20 years, and they've all been laughable. But for decades, of course, Europe and North America have staked a claim to being leading liberal democracy. But when it comes to showing leadership on tackling tax havens, and of course many tax havens are European or North American, neither of these continents are willing to take effective political action. 17 blacklisted countries, including such prominent offshore financial centres as Mongolia, for goodness sake, Namibia and Tunisia. What's extraordinary about this blacklist lies, of course, as you've said, with the omissions. No mention of tax haven USA or Switzerland, Hong Kong, Singapore. 4 out of the 5 top tax havens on the Tax Justice Network's Financial Secrecy Index. No mention of Belgium, Ireland, Luxembourg, Netherlands, all of them EU member states, and undoubtedly tax havens.
Malta,
of course. And last but definitely not least, no mention of the UK, which operates tax havens across the globe, including British Virgin Islands, Cayman, Channel Islands, Isle of Man, etc., etc., etc. Now, admittedly, some of these jurisdictions have ended up on the so-called grey list.
Right, which we could, I think it's fair to say, it's a bit like the naughty step where, you kind of kick the can down the road. You're either not compliant or you are compliant, and they've put these countries in a grey list. They've all promised that they're very sorry and they will do better.
Well, they will have to make some reforms. We don't know what timeline is going to apply to these reforms and so on around the treatment of, corporate profit shifting and so on. And this is where they've made such a bad mistake with this blacklist. We've already heard Bermudan government officials and officials from other tax haven jurisdictions crowing about the fact that they're excluded from the blacklist. We're not on the blacklist, therefore we're okay. And at the same time, I heard Tunisian officials on French radio recently complaining about the blacklist being so politically biased. And who can blame them for saying that? So the EU commissioner who spent 2 years working on this, Pierre Moscovici, the Frenchman, seems not to have learned a key lesson of leadership, which is get your own house in order before you point fingers at others. And Europe quite clearly isn't prepared to tackle the issue of its own homegrown tax havens, but is quite prepared to point fingers at countries like Namibia and Tunisia and Mongolia.
Yes, and on that, those countries, they've had some interesting reactions to finding themselves on this blacklist. We've had Guam on their blacklisting saying, well, they never contacted us and we can't actually sign international agreements because we're a US territory.
Yes.
Namibia said, well, yes, it's true that we didn't respond on time to questions around this blacklisting, but here's a description of our tax system and it really is nothing like a tax haven. And Mongolia said, well, we just don't have the capacity to sign up to demanding international agreements, but we do the best we can.
Yeah,
it really is a joke.
Think about about it carefully. I'm not, many non-residents of Mongolia will want to hold their assets in Mongolian currency inside the Mongolian tax territory at all. I mean, let's be reasonable about this. Mongolia, Switzerland, you know, put them in the balance. Now, you can see that Switzerland is clearly the more important issue, and yet Switzerland doesn't make the list. And that tells me that this list stinks.
Yes, and actually the Tax Justice Network, before this list was released, based on the European Union's own criteria, created their own blacklist.
That's right.
Using that criteria, and they found 41 countries that should be on the blacklist using that criteria, which previously has not been very transparent. And we still don't know what the sanctions should be. And if you want to know what the real deal is, then the Financial Secrecy Index, the latest one, will be launched on the 30th of January in 2018, and you'll get a lot more information there. A very objective assessment of the real problems in the world when it comes to tax havens.
That's right, yeah. The results are imminent. We've expanded the index. There are more countries involved, a wider range of indicators. It's a bigger, better product, and it doesn't suffer from the political bias that you get from both the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development and the European Union.
Thanks, John. So, the Tax Justice Network's latest Financial Secrecy Index is out on the 30th of January 2018. Put that in your diaries. We'll cover the results right here on the next TaxCast, which will be out a little bit later than usual. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. Just as the latest offshore leak for Paradise Papers is continuing the exposure of the offshore world, the repercussions from the Panama Papers are very far from over. This month, the TaxCast talks with two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Jake Bernstein about his new book, Secrecy World, Inside the Panama Papers Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite. It's like an offshore thriller, a gripping read from someone who was actually inside the whole scandal. Jake got unprecedented access to the kind of stars of the Panama Papers, the lawyers who set up the offshore law firm, Mossack Fonseca, the source of the big leak, Jürgen Mossack and Ramon Fonseca. OK, Jake, let's start with Jürgen Mossack and Ramon Fonseca. With offshore, I'm always curious about what makes people working in that industry tick and how they can lose their moral inhibitions if they ever had them. Do you feel any closer in understanding them as people?
I do. I mean, this was one of the central questions that I set out to discover when I decided to do the book. Because of the way that these leak investigations are structured, you can't really spend that much time with the person that you're investigating until towards the end of the project, because you can't let them know that you've got this massive leak. So the motivations and the sort of human dimension of what Ramon and Jürgen were really like was sort of a question mark. And fortunately for this project, they really spoke with me quite a bit, which they had never done before with any foreign journalist, not at least at length. And I did get a better sense of who they were as people and what their motivations were and how they saw themselves and what it was like to sort of have this massive media bomb dropped on them kind of out of nowhere.
What's really fascinating to me is that actually Fonseca, Ramon Fonseca, started out as quite an idealist. Very interesting, and he was very involved in politics and social reform and anti-poverty initiatives. Very surprising that he could move from that to the type of business he ended up in.
I mean, Ramon's trajectory is absolutely fascinating. I mean, he comes from quite prominent in the sense of being politically active family. His maternal grandfather, Ramon Mora, was U.S. educated, a dentist who owned a rum factory also, and was a strident sort of anti-imperialist, anti-Yankee. He rebelled against the canal treaty that the U.S. had imposed on Panama, and he was one of the main leaders in a coup in 1931. And Ramon's paternal grandfather was the Costa Rican ambassador. So Ramon had sort of grown up in a family that sort of prized civic engagement. And he wanted to be a priest at one point. And what really sort of influenced him the most was he fell under the sway of this very charismatic priest, Colombian priest named Hector Gallego, who was an adherent of liberation theology. You know, this idea that the church's responsibility was to help the poor, not just spiritually, but also politically and economically. And Gallego's parish was in the Panamanian province of Veraguas, where campesinos lived in almost feudal conditions. I mean, really terrible stuff, you know, infant mortality off the charts and malnutrition. And they basically, you know, lived to serve these big landowners. And Ramon goes up there to help Gallego and ends up doing stuff like burying babies who died from diseases caused by malnutrition. And I mean, really impactful stuff. But what happened was Gallego gets kidnapped by the military in 1971 and disappeared. And this, I think, had a huge impact on Ramon and it sort of sends him back to school where he gets his law degree and becomes a student leader. And he then gets recruited by the UN, which has a quota system and they need Central American lawyers. And he goes to work for the UN Conference on Trade and Development in Geneva. And that is sort of where he says he lost his idealism. I mean, he's working in the UN and he sees his bosses and they're really only interested in junkets and shopping for them and their wives and really just sort of doing stuff for themselves rather than for the common good. And he kind of abandons the UN after 4 or 5 years and comes back to Panama. And something quite consequential happened to him while he was in Geneva. He met a lawyer, Geneva lawyer, who wanted to create Panama companies, anonymous shell companies. But she couldn't do that because you have to be a Panamanian lawyer in order to create these companies. And that kind of set him on the course that would shape his life.
Right, and with Jürgen Mossack, it's a little easier to see the trajectory, right? Because with his father being involved with the Nazis, you know, it's a little less complex in a way.
It is, although it's interesting. I think, I mean, Jürgen comes to Panama as a child. He's 13 when his father moves the family. And at that point, Jürgen doesn't speak Spanish or English. He only speaks German. They're sort of dropped down into this alien world. He's the oldest of four children. And I think they really looked inward. You know, the family was very tight and they had sort of an immigrant zeal to succeed. And then there's this sort of dark past that the father had that I don't think anyone probably talked about. And this sort of sets Jürgen's trajectory because he's sort of secretive and he's ambitious. And I think those were big sort of motivators that made him the perfect person for this new business. And they also, you know, they joined forces, Ramon and Jürgen, at a very propitious time for the offshore world. It's sort of the mid-1980s. In the developing world, there's a growing wealth creation going on, you know, a bit of a burgeoning middle class, and they want to get their money out, particularly in China and Russia in the 90s. And so they're kind of at the perfect moment to push this model that they have created. The psychology of this is a sort of a fascinating question with Ramon and Jürgen. The way the system is set up, you can have a certain remove, right? So I am not really responsible for what this company does. I'm just selling a company to a banker or a lawyer or an accountant, and then they in turn are the ones who really bear the responsibility. And it becomes sort of a hot potato. There's a lovely moment in my book, Secrecy World, where there's a meeting between UBS Bank and Mossack Fonseca. Mossack Fonseca contacted UBS and said, we need information on these companies that you asked us to create. You know, now the regulators are saying we need to know stuff about them. And so you really have to get this for us. And then UBS says, well, they're not our companies. They're your companies. We don't have any responsibility for them at all. And one of the Mossack Fonseca people sort of notes, you know, acidly, that UBS was marking up the companies. They would buy them from Mossack Fonseca and then sell them to their clients at a markup. So for them to declaim responsibility for it was quite patently ridiculous. But the way the system is set up is that nobody really has to declare responsibility for their activities. And that remove allows you to pretend that you are not the one who's actually enabling money laundering or criminality or tax evasion on a you know, a massive scale.
And I think I would add to that, over and over again, with all the people that work in offshore and defend those practices, they're really emboldened by being able to point the finger at the United States and the United Kingdom and Luxembourg and places like this and say, but we're not as bad, or, you know, these places are bigger than us. It's more important. It happens all the time.
And sadly, with some justification, right? I mean, Delaware, it's like $1 billion a year for them in revenue just for the fees that they tack on to these companies. And that's just Delaware. That's not Nevada and Wyoming and the other ones that participate in this. So you're right. I mean, Jürgen Mosek says, you know, we were pushed aside and destroyed, but the real beneficiaries are the United States and the UK. And there's quite a bit of truth to that. The United States has really been a laggard as far as clamping down on this stuff. And in fact, one of the things that they recently did, it took several years in rulemaking purgatory before the Obama administration finally came out with a beneficial ownership rule for banks, for foreign companies and, you know, anonymous shell companies. And it's just full of holes, this rule. And I had one person who was involved in the process sort of admit that the lawyers and the bankers and other people really, you know, exercised incredible lobbying power and managed to water it down significantly. And now under this new rule, if they own less than 25%, or if they're hiding behind a lawyer, then the banks legally don't have to know. And it's a real problem. So, yes, I think that the cries of the Panamanians and the people in the BVI and others that that there is something deeply unfair about the criticism of them, even as the larger powers plunge headfirst into this business and reap the benefits of it, is absolutely true. As you know well as anybody, is the two places that truly dominate this world are the United States and the UK. And the U.S. incorporation law in Delaware is sort of the template for Panama and for the BVI, for Mossack Fonseca's experiment with the island nation of Nui in the Pacific. And they really picked up from there and went with it.
Right, exactly. And you can't say that Mossack and Fonseca didn't know exactly what they were doing. They were really very cynical from reading the process they went through, setting up this company, franchising out to other jurisdictions. And their first visit to the British Virgin Islands was really interesting. They needed some nice kind of British overseas territory, nice stable environment with British or Anglo law. And we've always said that the Panama Papers could just as easily have been called the British Virgin Island Papers, since it was such a favorite location.
I think people in Panama would have preferred that, for sure. Yeah, I mean, they really put the British Virgin Islands on the map as far as, you know, anonymous companies are concerned. And in fact, Ramon said to me at one point that because they had, the British Virgin Islands had just fined Mossack Fonseca $500,000, which is sort of an extraordinarily large fine for the British Virgin Islands. And he said bitterly to me that they should build a statue to me on the British Virgin Islands, not fine us $500,000, because they were kind of the first popularizers of a newly created incorporation law in the BVI. And not long after they started to have quite a bit of success, other Panamanian companies, firms like Morgan & Morgan and other incorporators started to come into the BVI and really make it take off. But I mean, the BVI was the big player in this space for so many years. And in China, they have referred to anonymous companies as BVIs, not as shell companies or anonymous companies, but the shorthand was BVI, just because everyone ended up in the BVI, at least during that period.
I didn't know that. What has been happening in the last decade or so, I think, has been a squeezing of the secrecy space to do business. And what's really interesting in the book, I think, is, you know, as different initiatives and policies are introduced and implemented, like the European Union's Savings Directive, which was basically an anti-tax evasion and money laundering initiative, Mossack Fonseca reaped some great rewards from that. And I mean, the hope is that as that space is squeezed, it becomes less and less desirable and practical to use offshore secrecy. Mossack Fonseca, they've done 2 months in jail because they were deemed a flight risk. They've been bailed out now. Their company looks like it's on its last legs. Where are they at now?
Mossack Fonseca now is, before this leak, they had about 600 employees. They have about 80 now. And really, they're spending most of their time not creating new companies, but still doing the due diligence for the old companies because the jurisdictions continue to demand it.
My sources in Panama say that there are at least 6 judicial actions sort of revolving around them. We'll see what becomes of them. And in response, they're keeping a very low profile. Ramon was a habitual tweeter. He spent a lot of time on social media, and he has completely withdrawn from that. And Durgan is also keeping a low profile. I think they're just waiting to see how this all shakes out and sort of to keep their head down for the moment.
Right. And in your book, you talk about the North Star of the Panama Papers, and that would be Vladimir Putin, who apparently declares $110,000 income a year. And you say in the book that Russia's interference with the US elections was in part because he was just so angry about being exposed by the Panama Papers. I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about that.
This is one of the conclusions, actually, that U.S. intelligence services came up with. They thought that one of the factors for the Russian attack on the U.S. election process was that he was so outraged over the Panama Papers expose, because it really went directly to his circle of people around him and raised serious questions about whether he was looting, the state, basically through a state-owned bank. And I think, this is complete conjecture on my part, but in Russia, generally, these kinds of big investigations don't happen. The government has a much tighter control over the press. And so perhaps the perspective was that this kind of thing would not have happened without at least the say-so of the Obama administration. But this really came from U.S. intelligence, this idea that he was, enraged by it. Certainly, the amazing thing for us was we sent a list of questions to the Kremlin before the publication of our Russia story, including stuff like, were you involved in the death of Mikhail Lessin, your former communications director, in a hotel room in Washington, D.C. And the Kremlin took the extraordinary step of denouncing our story before it was even published. They held a press conference and denounced the coming publication of the story, not even waiting until it came out, which was amazing.
Yes, and another thing that the Panama Papers, and certainly now the Paradise Papers, has really highlighted is the relationship between President Trump and Putin as kind of kindred spirits, really, if you think about it. Neither of them like the free press too much. They're both prolific users and beneficiaries of offshore and secrecy. And, what has been exposed even further by the Paradise Papers now, building on the Panama Papers exposés, have been the dealings Trump has had and his associates have had with Russians and Russian banks close to the Russian elites, and really major national and global security concerns in terms of their business dealings and conflicts of interest. It's a very interesting time now, isn't it?
Yes. Trump admitted during his campaign that he had 515 companies, including 378 that were registered in Delaware. I found at least 9 of Trump's business associates that were mentioned in the documents, and they had all kinds of, interesting issues surrounding them, including bribery allegations in West Africa and prostitution allegations and also a lot of tax evasion. And a picture sort of emerges of this group of people, and I think to some degree of Trump as well. And these are people who create their own reality, right? The rules that bind the rest of us don't bind them. They kind of make it up and push the envelope all the time. And then the other thing is that they really benefit and depend on the state largesse, so they're tied into their nation's rulers and they get state assets and state contracts and they make a lot of money that way.
they intermarry amongst themselves. I mean, marriages in this world are as much mergers as sort of love matches. And Trump is a great example of that. Ivanka marries Jared Kushner, and these are two real estate empires that are joined. And you have this sort of sense of an oligarchy, and it is transnational. And with that, of course, as you mentioned, comes a contempt of the press or really any authority that can challenge them. So that also includes in the United States, unfortunately, the justice system and rule of law. And they are to some degree enabled by the secrecy world, by the anonymity that allows them to hide their activities and sometimes their looting of public assets. And the other thing that's very interesting is that a lot of these people are very much within Russia's orbit. You know, they are connected to Putin in one way or another, and they certainly are following a similar model that, that Putin has really laid down.
Yeah, right. I mean, Donald Trump has shown open support for bribery, really, you could say, because, you know, one of the first things his government did was to repeal the anti-corruption measure, meaning that oil and mining extractive industries had to declare payments made to foreign governments. And he actually said, well, if you don't bribe, you don't do business in these places.
Yeah, I mean, it's truly extraordinary. I mean, this is, you have to remember, this is the guy who, when he was called out for not paying taxes in a debate, said, that makes me smart. The original idea behind his campaign was, I'm the one who knows how to game the system, so I'm the one who will be able to enforce the rules, and I'm the one who will be able to make sure that it's reformed properly. But that's not the way it has turned out. Instead, it's I'm the one who's gamed the system, and now I'm going to make it easier for other people who are as rich as me to game the system too.
Jake Bernstein's book is called Secrecy World, Inside the Panama Papers Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite. It's published by Henry Holton Company. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.